If you've noticed a shift in evangelicalism over the past 5 years, you're not alone. Aaron Wren, host of The Aaron Wren Show, joins us to talk about his book, Life in the Negative World, Confronting Challenges in an Anti-Christian Culture. In this episode, we talk about why figures like Jordan Peterson and Jocko Willink draw the attention of so many Christian young men who are struggling to make sense of their lives. We also discuss the shift from neutral world, in which Christianity serves as one religious option among many, to the more hostile negative world, as well as ways that this shift fractured and split the modern conservative evangelical movement. And finally, we talk about ways evangelicals can not only adapt to negative world, but also take advantage of new opportunities, all while navigating the difficult waters of modern politics. Enjoy this episode. You're listening to That'll Preach. We've got a guest on our show we're excited about. We've got Aaron Wren. Aaron Wren is a writer, podcaster, and consultant in Indianapolis. He's also the co-founder and senior fellow at American Reformer. He's got a podcast and a YouTube channel called The Aaron Wren Show, as well as a Substack. And he's on to talk today about a really exciting book I think he's written, a really helpful book. It's called Life in the Negative World, Confronting Challenges in an Anti-Christian Culture. Great little subtitle there, and really relevant to some of the things that you've been writing about for a long time. So, Aaron, Thank you for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I first started reading your stuff when you had a newsletter. I think it was called The Masculinist back in the day, and you were writing on a lot of different topics that I felt like a lot of people weren't writing about, especially in the Christian world. And I remember when your Three Worlds of Evangelicalism article came out. I think it came out in First Things.
Yep.
I remember reading that and thinking, this guy has his pulse on something that I'm like, oh yeah, I can see that this is a very accurate portrayal of understanding Christianity and its relation to culture in America. And so I thought it was a very insightful article, and I'm pleased to find out that you've now written a full-length book on it. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, just from your own life, your own biography, what got you interested in writing about the negative world? Maybe you could even talk a little bit how those kind of concepts started percolating in your mind leading up to your article and then your book.
Well, the way my mind works is it's like there's a huge funnel at the top that like all the observations that I'm making about the world are constantly flowing into it. All the books that I read, the articles, even the things I just see, you know, when I walk down the street and I look at something, oh, look at that building. And then over time, I just sort of synthesize little structures, start making connections between things and create patterns and thoughts about the world. And so this gives me, I think, one of the things it's given me is an ability to see kind of connections and patterns that other people haven't necessarily seen yet and be able to articulate them. The other thing that I have is, I don't know if it's a blessing or a curse, is, you know, a willingness to say things that are sort of not the things everybody else is saying. And they're not even that they're unpopular things. It's just most people follow the crowd. That's like the nature of the beast. You know, we all do that. And if I see something that I think maybe even goes against the crowd, I'm like, yeah, I see that. That's right. And I'm willing to say it. And so actually my background has been in management consulting, and something like the Three Worlds of Evangelicalism is very much something that would come from a kind of a management consulting type perspective of the world. But then I got interested in cities. I grew up and grown up in a rural area and moved to Chicago after college. So I got very interested in cities after living in one, and, you know, started just seeing the same connections and writing, and turned it into a sort of a profession of that. And then I sort of applied the same thing to the church. And really what got me interested in it was, again, men's issues. I originally called my newsletter The Masculinist. It's still basically the same newsletter, but I rebranded it after myself. You know, over a decade ago now, I saw that young men were turning to online influencers. They weren't turning to the church. They weren't turning to traditional authorities. They were looking to online gurus to tell them about life, what they should be wanting out of life, you know, how to get what they want out of life. And this was even before Jordan Peterson came along. You know, I don't think Jordan Peterson created this segment. I think he was in somewhat a product of it. His timing was impeccable in coming along right as men were looking for guides online. And of course, it used to be tough to explain this to people, But then when Jordan Peterson came along, it's like everybody gets, oh, they're turning to Jordan Peterson. They're turning to Joe Rogan. They're turning to Jocko Willink. They're turning to people like Andrew Tate. Although, frankly, I think Andrew Tate is mostly a teenage phenomenon more than a, you know, adult male phenomenon. Nevertheless, I thought it was interesting. You know, the people are not turning to the church. They're turning to these guys. Why is that? So I thought, you know, there's actually a lot of things about the messages some of these people have that's compelling in a lot of ways. They may not have a Christian theology or often have kind of immoral aims, many of them. But yet a lot of what they're saying about the world actually has a lot of diagnostic accuracy to it. And I saw, for example, that what the church was saying was either incomplete or incorrect. And so just as one example of that, it's one of the most well-known statistics in social science that women initiate the vast majority of divorces. You know, how many varies by source, but basically around 70% of all divorces are initiated by women. You'll never hear that from any pastor. You know, if you listen to a sermon, you know, it's almost always family breakdown is like the man dumping his wife for some reason. And again, why these women are filing for divorce is complicated. We could, you know, not need to go into that here, but just that basic stat is never presented in church. And so when you hear, you know, some guys out there, you know, and the online people are telling you this stuff, and you're like, wow, they're telling me things the church isn't telling me. What's going on here? People gravitate to that. And so I really wanted to engage on that issue. And then, you know, I just started writing about other topics. Again, I was originally going to shut my newsletter down because it wasn't as popular as I wanted it to be. And I said, well, maybe I should just throw out any of my couple last best ideas on any topic. Forget men's issues. I'll just write in general what I think about the world of evangelicalism. And then I'll shut it down. And one of them was the Three Worlds of Evangelicalism, the original version of it. And it blew up. And so, you know, I sort of wrote about that because the market demanded it, I guess. But that's kind of how I came to write about it. And so now I sort of like write about a variety of issues.
That's fascinating. I mean, I feel like Jordan Peterson was like the indie band that I listened to when he first came out, and then he became like mainstream. You know, I remember finding his lectures online on YouTube in like 2014, 2015, and thinking like, I remember thinking like, well, this guy's not a Christian. But then when he says stuff, I'm like, he's saying things that sound like reality. That sound like, you know, and he said it with a lot of precision, and he had, you know, he had his degree. I mean, got his PhD in psychology. He's taught it for a long time. And I was one of those guys. I mean, I really, especially early on, like Peterson's online lectures, when they put the stuff that he did when he was teaching his classes, I'm like, man, this is when there's all this madness and culture and all this stuff. It just sounded like somebody who was willing to just be direct. He was also willing to be wrong in a lot of ways. I thought he was actually pretty open-minded, but I remember that. I just had not experienced something like that.
And a lot of his early lectures that got popular were like 2-hour commentaries on Genesis.
I know.
He did a whole series of like 2-hour plus lectures on Genesis. And I'm like, it shows something profound that, you know, wow, young people really are willing to listen to 2-hour lectures on Genesis. They're interested in the Bible stories.
Right.
And
right.
The way he was talking about them was super compelling. And I think very few evangelicals have studied Jordan Peterson or thought about the way that he talks about the world. I think it's interesting. One of the points that I made, you know, and when I saw him is, you know, there's a lot of things I disagree with Jordan Peterson on.
Sure.
But like, he treats life as, you know, endeavor of the utmost moral seriousness, like how you live your life as what you think is a random individual has profound consequences, not just to yourself, but to the world. And, you know, part of the world's destiny will be lost if you do not rise to the challenge of what you're called to be. And I think a lot of young men respond to that. It's a sort of a heroic vision of manhood. And it's very serious. He's a very serious person. You know, he's not, he doesn't clown around. He's, you know, and I think part of it was he was a clinical practitioner for a long time too, doing therapy. So think about how good he got at learning about people's concerns and like how to speak with people. There's like a lot that came out of that.
It's pretty moving, even when you'll see him tear up
Over
stories of of men who have told him really hard things they've gone through and how they've overcome it. I mean, he has a great deal of compassion too.
Yeah, absolutely.
That I think is pretty profound.
And I feel like, you know, and a lot of the evangelical pastors, a lot of what they do is it's just man up lectures.
Right.
I mean, literally, you know, there might even be a, you know, an event where the words man up are like there. It's sort of hectoring. It's shaming. It doesn't offer anything noble. It's all about how basically you need to sacrifice yourself for other people. Which I think, you know, Peterson would probably say some of that too, but he puts it in a different register.
Yeah.
You know, it's talked about in a very different way. You know, there's something noble and heroic about the way he talks about life. And you don't necessarily get that from, you know, I think modern evangelicalism for whatever reason. Whereas I think, you know, just saying, you know, the way he talked about, I just, when I saw him here in Indianapolis a couple weeks ago, he sold out a 2,500 seat theater and he gave a commentary on the call of Abraham. And like part of the idea of Abraham leaving his home and going, you know, to the place he doesn't know where God's taking him is, you know, Peterson presents that as God is calling him to an adventure. And I think there's a sense in which that's true. You know, he was called on an adventure. Paul, you know, after his calling on the road to Damascus, he did live an incredibly adventurous life. And again, you know, in many ways, a heroic life, many, you know, almost like a movie. Like how many times did he barely escape with his life from yet another thing? It's a really, you know, and things like that idea that, you know, the Christian life is a life of adventure. You know, we're on an adventure with God, and albeit one that's, you know, actually safe because he's in charge.
Right.
And, you know, and so many things there. And so I think there is a lot to the way these guys talk. And Peterson, of course, he's been the most successful of most of them, is also good, good. I mean, I always find Jocko Willink interesting too. He's a Navy SEAL, former Navy SEAL, wrote the book Extreme Ownership, super popular guy. I tend not to listen to his lectures. I mean, I like written content. Jocko is so thoughtful, and like he'll spend 15 minutes just going through some introductory point because he really likes to be precise and like the way he talks. I just don't have time to listen to it, but the content's excellent.
Yeah.
And again, the other thing about Jocko, he's very serious. Like Jocko is not like just kidding around. He's like, this is like serious stuff. And a lot of it's just like the basics. And both for Peterson too. I mean, a lot of Peterson, like his famous line was, you know, clean your room, bucko, or something like that. A lot of it's just basic stuff. It's like, you know, Jocko's like, you know, here's what's going to happen. One day, you're just not going to feel like going to the gym, and you're not going to go. And then that's going to happen again. So he talks about the way that we like lose focus and like lose discipline. He talks about how discipline equals freedom. And again, not everybody resonates with that style, but I mean, he's got like a lot of guys like posting pictures of their alarm clock at 4:30 in the morning, getting up to go to the gym. It's like, okay, great. If you really want to go to the gym every day, you got to do it at a time when you know there's not going to be any other interruptions. And that's early morning. If you get up at 4:30 in the morning and go to the gym, there's probably not going to be anything that conflicts with that. So you just need to set your alarm and just do it. Mm-hmm. There's nothing magic about it. Just actually do it. You actually can do it. You actually convincing people that they actually can get up at 4:30 in the morning and go to the gym and then seeing them do it like, wow, I can actually do this stuff. There's a lot of practicalities and you see how it responds, and not everybody responds with, you know, every single person. But you know, I also think, you know, again, with Jocko, a lot of it is, you know, he's Navy SEAL. It's like about being elite. It's about like, you know, you need to hold yourself to a higher standard than other people. You need to be dialed in on excellence and really bringing your A game to every single thing that you do. And I think there's a thing that like people respond to that. There was some art, I can't remember exactly where I saw this, but they were talking about the Marine Corps and their ability to recruit people. You know, even though like they're known for like tough boot camps and all their messages, he's like, this guy's like, look, never underestimate the motivating power of excellence. That the call to excellence can really be a motivating force for people. And yeah,
that's, I mean, I remember thinking, wow, like he was talking about when he was in the SEALs, he was talking about how whenever there would be a challenge or something negative would happen, he would train himself to say good.
Mm.
And that mental switch, sometimes throughout my day, I just have, like, I feel like I have Jocko's head floating, you know, like a ghost in front of me being like, say good, you know, when, but that mind shift is saying like, okay, how do you actually face hard things with courage and also see the possibility in them? And so, but you've got to know the challenges. And what I appreciate about your book is that you're very forthright and direct about the challenges of negative world, of a world that's hostile to Christianity, but you're not doom and gloom about it. You actually have some insights about there could be great opportunity in the midst of these challenges. So maybe just for background for our listeners, what are some of the challenges that you see that make up what you are envisioning as negative world? What are some things that you started to see?
Well, first, I'm glad I'm not the only one that's got a hologram of Jocko that comes up and like says, just do it.
Yeah, I know, right?
Just go do it. The next hit's something I don't want to do.
Yeah, I know.
You just got to do it. Yeah, you know, I make the point in the book, you know, I kind of lay out this model. If you go back, you know, again, for much of American history, although we didn't have a state church like in Europe, we did have a soft, sort of softly institutionalized generic Protestantism as our default national religion. And, you know, again, in the 50s, half of all adults attended church. There was prayer and Bible reading in public schools, all that sort of stuff. That started to become unraveled in the 1960s. Christianity went into a period of decline, and it's still declining, to be quite honest. So, you know, and I divide that period of decline from, say, 1964 to the present into three eras or worlds that I call the positive, the neutral, and the negative world. So the positive world is from 64 to 94, and it's a period of decline for Christianity. I want to make that clear. At the same time, Christianity is still basically viewed positively. You know, being known as a good church-going man makes you seem like an upstanding member of society. It makes people want to vote for you if you're a candidate. Christian moral norms are still the basic moral norms of society. And if you don't follow them, you can get in trouble. Around 1994, we had a tipping point in what I call the neutral world. Christianity is not seen positively anymore, but it's not really viewed negatively yet either. It's just one more lifestyle choice among many in a sort of pluralistic public square. Then in 2014, we had a second tipping point. Enter what I call the negative world, where for the first time in the 400-year history of America, official elite culture is now explicitly negative towards Christianity. You know, being known as a Bible-believing Christian does not help you get a job in the elite sectors of the economy. Quite the opposite. Christian morality is now expressly repudiated and is in fact seen as the leading threat to the new public moral order by a lot of people. I think all the talk about Christian nationalism is very much in this vein. And so, you know, I think that has been a dislocating experience for a lot of American evangelicals who are used to thinking themselves as a, you know, moral majority, to pick the name of Jerry Falwell's organization. Well, that's ludicrous now. The reality is, I think we can see around us that things evangelicals might want are not popular in the culture. You know, we've seen this in the abortion votes. Every time abortion gets put on the ballot, the pro-abortion side wins, even in deep red states like Kentucky. The reality is the evangelical position is a minority position, and therefore we need to make adjustments to think about that and like adjust to what it means to be a minority in society.
You know, when you were talking about the negative world and also the shift, you know, the rapid shift, I remember growing up watching like Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, you know, as a teenager, and I wasn't a Christian. I was like, this was like that liberal kind of talk show was like the underground against this kind of Bush conservative backdrop. You know what I mean? Like they were the mischievous people. And now it's like, I don't even know if people watch The Daily Show much. I mean, I know that like it's become the mainstream idea, and it doesn't have. And so just that vibe kind of switched for me where I'm like, it used to be that the very liberal talking points were like, those are all the comedians. They're saying you know, it was sort of unsavory to say those kind of progressive things. And now it's just, it's kind of the opposite. Now people, the alternate forms of media are geared toward conservatives because they feel like they can't speak those things in the public sphere. So it's an interesting kind of dynamic shift I noticed reading your book.
Yeah, and that's true. And the other thing, you know, you'll see even on the right, I mean, we're entering the age of the post-Christian right in America. And I think that's one of the things that has really been, I think Donald Trump's election in 2016 and near election in 2020 and possibly getting elected this year, I think causes people to, misunderstand the culture with regards to Christianity, because I think a lot of people in their mind, it's like evangelical equal Republican. And therefore, if Republicans are winning, that must mean things are good for evangelicals. In fact, what we're seeing is, I think, you know, the majority of Republicans are not evangelicals. The majority of Republicans are, you know, they're the post-Christian right. You know, it's people who, they don't like wokeness necessarily all that much. Maybe they don't like immigration. Maybe there's a lot of things they don't like. But they're not interested in social conservative policies. They're not interested in religion. And if you'll notice, most of the edgy online right writing and culture is driven by non-Christian people. It's the dissident right people like BAP or like Manosphere writers or even Jordan Peterson. You know, it's not, you know, the edgy Southern Baptist preacher, you know, that people are turning into as thinking it's cool. It's, you know, so it's a, I think that the, you know, Republican electoral success is, you know, a sort of mass, is caused people to misunderstand the fact that, you know, evangelicalism, Christianity has been in significant decline. Whatever the Republican Party believes in the future, it's not going to believe sort of social conservatism, you know, for example, definitely moving away from that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's entirely plausible. It may even be the fact now that I don't think you could run on the Republican platform and publicly say that you're opposed to same-sex marriage or something like that. I think they would view that as political suicide.
Yeah, I mean, probably there's some places, you know, in like rural counties and stuff, you know, people do that. But yeah, you know, people don't do that.
Right, right.
Well, you know, people don't do it, you know, like it's, yeah, exactly.
Oh, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Well, no, that's what I was saying. Like, I mean, like, you know, you go to D.C., you go to New York, you go around these Conservatism Inc. institutions. Yeah, there are some trad Catholic types, you know, in these organizations. But by and large, they're sort of what I call moderately socially liberal. They believe in what, you know, Amy Wax called bourgeois values. They'll talk about bourgeois values. So bourgeois values is, you know, working hard and not having kids out of wedlock. That sort of thing. But it's not like refraining from premarital sex or anything like that. It's not about anti-abortion. It's about, look, guys, let's not take this a little too far. I'm here. But it is still basically like pretty much on the socially liberal side of the equation. The only question is whether it's a behavior that sort of undermines individual success or, you know, economic growth or something like that. Otherwise, it's just fine to indulge. You know, they're probably okay. A lot of them are probably okay with, you know, the libertarian, you know, the libertarians were famously, you know, always the people that wanted to legalize pot. Yeah. Right. I say even now, like legalizing pot is probably the majority position in among the Republican voter. Hmm. You know, there's no constituency for making gambling illegal. You know, for example, it's like, I can't remember the last time I heard a preacher talk about gambling. But if you went back to the 1980s, like when my state of Indiana was legalizing the lottery, they had to pass a constitutional amendment to enable gambling to have a state lottery. You know, the churches were against it. And, you know, now you don't hear anybody in the churches talking about gambling. You know, it's like how passe. That's like saying you don't believe in dancing. You know, so that sort of stuff, you know.
Well, how do you see this negative world affecting the church? I think you have a lot of great observations in your book about that. You know, I became a Christian in the upsurge of the Young Restless Reform, you know, and that was a wild and exciting time. You know, it was just like churches being planted, everything's, you know, and I just think about how I look at like a picture of Together for the Gospel in 2012, and you're like, all these guys. And now you look today and they've all fractured off into different kinds of tribes. And I think I have to imagine some of that is different approaches to, or maybe even different awarenesses of the negative world and what that looks like. Can you talk about your observations about the negative world when it comes to evangelicalism and strategies of outreach?
Yeah, well, you know, the new Calvinism movement, the Young Restless Reformed. Firstly, I'll tell you, there's a great book. It's an academic book. You might want to try to get it from the library because it's really, really expensive. It's called The Reformed Resurgence, or Reformed Resurgence, by Brad Vermeulen, who's a sociologist. He did his dissertation on that. And then he has a book by Oxford University Press. Talks a lot about that movement, I think, in impressive analytical form. And yeah, I think that it really was a huge thing for a while. It was really a product of social media, not really social media, but the internet in a lot of ways, really the rise of the internet. And a lot of those guys, you know, the guys that came together to sort of create that movement, most of them, not all of them, but a lot of them were, you know, already kind of famous, heavy hitter type people, many of them baby boomers. And like a lot of them have just, you know, they've moved on. Tim Keller, major figure, has passed away. John Piper's retired. You know, John MacArthur probably doesn't have that many years left. Let's be
honest.
Somehow he's in his
80s. Still cranking, though. I mean, he's
you know, we had to like, you know, test his DNA to make sure he's human. Like, how can anybody have that much energy at his age? Is a little something else there. But you know, ultimately, I think a lot of it is just some of it's generational turnover. But part of it was, I think, when we flipped to the negative world, that movement really fractured because some people wanted it to go in essentially a woke direction, if you want to call it about that. Like, there was a massive swing in that group towards talking about racial justice and things like that. You know, it just became huge, you know, circa like it's like 2017. In fact, I even started doing some analysis of articles on the Gospel Coalition talking about race, because I'm like, man, every other article on here is about race. And that became a polarizing issue, I think, there. And then when you add to that matrix, Donald Trump's candidacy, you know, and again, the Young Restless and Reform, these were mostly conservative guys, I think, basically. You know, they weren't all per se Republicans, but they were basically culturally conservative people. But you know, they were also kind of apolitical. They were trying to go beyond politics. They're like this idea of the culture war of, you know, evangelicalism is about fighting with people all the time, about, you know, voting Republican. They wanted to get beyond that. Rightly so, I think, in my opinion. But then along comes Donald Trump. And, you know, some of these people kind of horrified, particularly since there was so much evangelical support for Donald Trump. And so I think that also put like a big, that really caused a lot of the people to, I don't want to say pivot's the right word, but they really wanted to make clear that they had nothing to do with Donald Trump, which of course a lot of the rank and file loved Donald Trump. So I think sort of wokeness in Trump really put enormous stress on that movement and frankly, most other movements, you know, a lot of other parts of evangelicalism, and create a lot of realignment, fracturing, you know, et cetera. And, you know, so that was big. I think that was big. And then COVID hit. COVID was another one that sort of like really polarized people and divided people. Although I think the COVID divisions sort of reinforced existing divisions rather than creating them. Whereas some of these other things, Trump and kind of wokeness sort of created fractures and kind of things that would have been unified in the past. So John MacArthur basically was very unhappy about the turn towards the sort of social justice thing, for example. He even put out, I think, a big statement about it, you know, that he was collecting signatures on, and, you know, kind of Together for the Gospel in part ended over that. And then, like, to be honest, they also had their share of scandals. You know, so you had Mark Driscoll. You know, Mark Driscoll was like a huge part of that Young Restless and Reformed, and he was Gen X, you know, and, you know, his ministry blew up right? Kind of really exploded in grand fashion. James McDonald was another big guy in that movement. James McDonald was sort of disgraced. Joshua Harris, who wasn't like the biggest name, you know, the I Kissed Dating Goodbye, like he sort of like, you know, apostatized from Christianity. There were also, again, scandals in other people's ministries there. So a number of their big guys had some scandals and things. And so that definitely also caused some issues there. And there's probably a lesson there, right? There was probably too many, you know, when you sort of create an all-star team of big name people, that's probably not all 100% healthy kind of thing.
You know, we actually, I remember at our church, we had purchased a bunch of Paul Tripp's book, Dangerous Calling. And that was kind of like, that's like the book to help pastors not fall into scandal. And I remember on one of the book jackets, it was like endorsed by Tully and Chavijian, James McDonald, you know, Joshua Harris. And you're just like, it's like a who's who's list of like, in a few short years, unfortunately, you know, I mean, it's terrible, but I just remember thinking like, wow.
He was involved at Mars Hill. He may have been on the oversight board or something.
Yeah,
it's not clear what his role was. He may have gotten called in to try to like help fix things.
Yeah.
And so I'm not saying that he did anything wrong. I don't really know, but I know there was something involving him and Mark Driscoll too. But yeah, I mean, a lot of these things just, you know, there were a lot of issues there.
I'm curious, in your book, you actually talk about how different streams of evangelicalism are going to respond differently. They're going to have different prudential strategies to how they encounter negative world. And tease that out a little bit more. How do you think we can actually, because there is a fracturing, is there a possibility where we can all sort of, you know, agree to disagree on some things, but get along? Because a lot of what you talk about is having a kind of sense of, you know, if we're all scattered apart, it's very hard to have any kind of assertive force in the political sphere or something, or in the social sphere. How do you see, is there any way forward where these quote unquote tribes, I know that's overused language, can kind of have a common union again, maybe like it used to be? Or is there a new way that could look? What are your thoughts on that?
I don't think it's trending that direction. I think it's trending towards more division. And I think the key is, you know, evangelicalism was really never a unified, coherent movement. So I think a lot of these guys disagreed with each other for a long time, but they sort of, you know, worked together because it seemed like there was a project that was worth working together on. So like apparently, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson didn't like each other. And you know, like, I don't think Jerry Falwell was a charismatic or a Pentecostal. So like he was more of a fundamentalist, traditional fundamentalist, but they, you know, that doesn't mean that they all, you know, were like buddy, buddy, but like they, you know, there was like something that they were working together on in a sense. There were benefits to saying evangelicalism is a thing, you know, and now I think in the part of the negative world is there's no benefit whatsoever to being called an evangelical. So why would you want to even preserve the idea of being part of evangelicalism? I started noticing this like, you know, a decade ago, that you would see people who, and some people even explicitly said this, I'm not an evangelical, I'm a Presbyterian. A lot of the kind of the people in like the Kellerite world, it's like, we're not evangelicals, we're Presbyterians. And now you'll hear people talk about Anglican. Anglican is the flavor of the month now. I'm an Anglican. They don't even use, they reject the even, so it's sort of a flight away from the evangelical label, because it's kind of toxic in the marketplace, in a sense. And so there's really no value in the evangelical brand, essentially. And I think a lot of these groups, you know, have fundamentally different social milieus and views of the world. And, you know, maybe the very last thing he wrote before he died was Tim Keller wrote this series of papers called The Decline and Renewal of the American Church or something like that. And he had rolled it out and then he sort of recombined like four installments. Then he put them all together and did a bunch of new additions. And one of his things is he's laying out like the landscape. He's like, there's four different groups here. And he's like, there's basically going to be a realignment. And his view was, we need to divide from the fundamentalists. He called it divide with tears. He's like, didn't mean, you know, that, you know, we should hate them or whatever. But like, there's no more basis for cooperation because we're too far apart. And instead, we need to partner with these people over here who previously we would not have partnered with. And so, like, the Young Restless and Reform movement was very complementarian in its gender theology. You know, like, the Gospel Coalition is constitutionally complementarian. You know, but Keller's saying we need to make common cause with more evangelical egalitarians. So it's a realignment of what things look like. And I don't, you know, think there was anything sinister about that. I think he was, in part of it, just responding to reality. He's like, look, these guys over here on, you know, the more conservative side of the equation, like, I don't agree with them. And a lot of us don't agree with them. And they don't agree with us. So why should we pretend that we're the same thing anymore? And so I think, you know, for example, like, if you're an evangelical who does not like Donald Trump, you're going to do everything in your power to make sure people know you are not a Trump supporter, that you are not like those other people. And so I think we're sort of in a disintegration phase more than an integration phase. And so, you know, where we'll come out of it on the other side of that, you know, I don't know. We're in sort of a, you know, disintegrating phase in society too. We're a less unified society. We're a more divided society. We're a more polarized society. And there you go.
It's a good point. I mean, in some ways, I think you touch on this in your book, where we're in the very beginning phases of kind of sorting this all out. I mean, the dust is still settling in a lot of ways, and there's going to be a big, you know, like you said, a lot of these, I think a lot of the cohesion, whether it was apparent or real, of that like 2007 to 2013 evangelical, everybody's buddies and, you know, was held together by the friendships of these pinnacle figures, MacArthur and Sproul and Piper and Keller, and they were all sort of, and Don Carson, they were all these, like, they were held together by their friendships, I felt like. And now that they're retiring, and now they have their own schools that are kind of more fracturing apart, it seems like that what was holding a lot of together was these personal relationships between these key figures.
And that was, you know, that was true. And that was also just, I mean, that was only one corner of the evangelical world. True. And I think, you know, one of the things Vermeulen in his Reform Resurgence book talk about is, like, numerically, like, the new Calvinists are like a small fraction of the overall evangelical landscape, but they had disproportionate influence. And so there were always people who were like strongly disagree with them, I think, on a lot of things, like the Neo-Anabaptists and the new monastic movement was also going about that time. You know, then there was kind of the emerging church, which turned into, like, you know, the whole Rob Bell and other stuff, and kind of progressive evangelicalism was developing. So there were other groups, I think, coming along. And one of the things Vermeulen talks about of his New Calvinism was, in essence, New Calvinism was itself a faction that was designed to compete with other factions to essentially control, like, evangelical orthodoxy and things of that nature. And so, again, evangelicalism was always more divided than we think. Although there was less overt, I think, fighting between a lot of these different groups. You know, when I look, you know, at the evangelical world, I got to be honest, it's kind of a strange place. You know, especially when I compare it to kind of other parts of the world, you know, a lot of it is sort of dominated by these sort of charismatic megachurch preachers or like seminary presidents. And, you know, it sort of operates on sort of patron client model, right? So you got to, like, you know, become a disciple of one of these guys, which sort of means you have to, like, be a yes man. And, you know, they really like to build up people with whom they're in alliances. And you could probably do a power map of evangelicalism just by looking at the speakers at different conferences. You know, who gets invited to speak at different conferences? And, you know, I would see, like, Hillsong in New York would put on a conference, and, you know, they'd have a whole group of speakers. And then there's, like, a Gospel Coalition conference, and they've, like, not even, there's no overlap. You know, one time I sort of did a look, and I, you know, because when Hillsong, before Hillsong went through its problems, you know, Hillsong was basically like the evangelical megachurch in New York. They had like 8,000 people there, tons of celebrities. And, you know, Redeemer was still huge, you know, had like 5,000 people, all that. And I'm like, have these guys ever talked to each other? And so I went, I was Googling and Googling and Googling, and I could never find a time in which Carl Lentz and Tim Keller had appeared together or talked about each other at all. Except one time, a journalist asked Carl Lentz, oh, I know you're in the same city with Tim Keller. What do you think of him? He's like, he just made some, like, kind of not like, oh, yeah, yeah, I think we kind of basically believe sort of same thing, good guy. It was just sort of like, where there wasn't any, like, real engagement there. And so it's like, you've got these, like, two people who are right there, both evangelicals, both gigantic successful pastors, and they don't even talk to each other. They don't collaborate. They don't do anything. And it's, like, weird. Like, I saw the other thing is, like, people talk about Tim Keller coming to New York to start Redeemer Presbyterian Church in 1989. And, you know, I don't think he's ever claimed this, but like a lot of people say, well, that was like the first evangelical church plant in, you know, New York. And I'm like, actually, in 1987, David Wilkerson, the guy who wrote The Cross and the Switchblade, if you're familiar with that book, he came back to New York City and founded a church in Times Square called Times Square Church. And Times Square Church is actually still a very successful, multiracial, evangelical megachurch that owns a Broadway theater at like 50th and 7th Avenue. It's so packed. You like have to get there 15 minutes early to get a seat. And it's not like you just walk in and you just walk in and decide which seat you want. Like they're guiding you. They're like filling up the rows like one by one. So like Every single seat is taken in this theater for multiple services. And I'm like, did these guys ever talk to Hillsong, ever talk to Redeemer? Like, not that I can tell. It's like they all sort of pretend the other people didn't even exist. And so it really is an odd thing. And I think part of what you're saying is, you know, in this young, restless, reformed world, they sort of acted as if they were the universe. This is the universe of evangelicalism. And it's really kind of wild. I mean, there's some weird social dynamics of it that I haven't fully cracked the code, and I probably never will because I don't have the leisure to study it. And like a sociologist should study it, or like a business school professor should study it, you know? So it's like there's all these different, like, even within Manhattan, very successful evangelical megachurches of different flavors, and none of them seem to talk to each other. They don't attack each other, but they don't even talk to each other. They don't collaborate. It's not like, you know, oh, we're getting together for like a prayer meeting. All the evangelical pastors in Manhattan, we're all going to get together. We're going to pray for each other's churches. We're going to pray for the city. Like, I never once heard of anything like that happening.
I remember, I can't remember who it was. Somebody mentioned a dynamic. He was talking about seminaries, how if you're a conservative evangelical seminary, you have a very limited pot of people who are going to come to your school. And so you are working with people where they're already conservative. So you have to super specialize. We're missional. We're, you know, cultural engagement. We're Reformed, Orthodox, whatever. And you have to like super fine tune. And I wonder if there's a dynamic there with a conservative evangelical church. You only have a small subsection of people who are going to go to that church. And then you have to think, well, we're conservative, but the selling point of coming to our church is this kind of niche, you know, kind of alignment or kind of idea.
Yeah, there, and you know, there's nothing wrong with serving a particular niche.
Sure.
I mean, I don't think that's bad. I just think it's weird that when people sort of like don't pretend that like, so I think the key is evangelicalism was never as unified as people wanted. I think it was very siloed. I think it was very hierarchical. I think, again, it was very patron client oriented. It's very closed network, meaning, you know, with like New Calvinism, like Young, Restless, and Reformed, we're all going to blurb each other's books. We're going to promote each other. We're going to speak at each other's conferences. But if you're not part of our club and you're not like a loyalist to our group, like we're certainly not going to promote what you're doing. And so there is a kind of interesting thing there. Like, I don't think it's any accident that my Three Worlds article was published in First Things magazine, which is basically Catholic run. I mean, most of the people that have promoted my work have actually been like Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, or like, you know, different things like that. It's like, I don't get a lot of love from, call it elite evangelicalism. I don't get a lot of hate either. But like, somebody like me doesn't map into their world, you know, all that much. And so it's a different kind of, it's a weird culture, and I haven't fully figured it out yet. And again, I probably never will figure it out, but I think it's fracturing, you know, as well. So that's where we're in, a sort of a fracturing world.
So that is an interesting thing that you notice. I mean, and you do in your book, you look at Roman Catholics as an interesting model that evangelicals can take some insights from. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, sure. You know, as I said, you know, we're now a minority. You know, what does it look like to live as a minority? So maybe we can learn from other minorities. And, you know, I don't think it makes sense to look at, for example, Jews. Like, let's learn some lessons. Well, first off, Jews are a religious group, but they're also an ethnic group. They're also very small. They've also been historically persecuted. And there's a lot going on there that I think, you know, they've got some very impressive communities, I think, in incredible ways. But I don't think that we could learn to like be like Jews in America. Whereas I think, so I use the example of early 20th century Catholicism. Is it a perfect? Mormons, I think, are another interesting example as well. But, you know, early 20th century Catholicism, first off, there's a lot of Catholics, just like there were a lot of Protestants. You know, they were, you know, multiple ethnicities. So it's not just linked to a particular ethnic group. It's, you know, and so they were sort of disfavored, but they weren't, you know, so it was an anti-Catholic country and Catholics were viewed with suspicion and this and that. But it wasn't like they were being treated like blacks. So you can't, that's why I say, oh, don't learn, you know, blacks were like uniquely discriminated against in America, which, you know, in a way Catholics weren't. So it's like, I call it a milder form of negativity. And nevertheless, you know, the Catholics, you know, they had to, you know, they had to learn how to be faithful Catholics in a Protestant country. Just like if we went to a very heavily Catholic country like Italy, we'd have to be like, oh, we can't just go along with the Italian culture because that's a Catholic culture. We have to have our own things. And so they built their own Catholic schools, Catholic universities, Catholic fraternal societies. They built infrastructure to sort of sustain Catholic life and those sorts of things. And so that's basically how it works there. That's what I would say. And that's why I use that example. You know, the Catholics, I think Catholics even today, right? Why are there so many Catholic intellectuals? You know, like a lot of people will, for example, they'll say, oh, look at Charles Taylor's A Secular Age to talk about secularization. He's a Catholic philosopher. Or they'll say, look at Patrick Deneen, a Notre Dame professor, political science professor, why liberalism failed. The political diagnostics are coming from Catholic. They're looking to Catholic intellectuals. Why is that? Well, Catholics, among other things, they nurture and support Catholic intellectuals in a way that Protestant figures don't. And again, this gets to the point of, you know, I think some of the way evangelicalism functions. There's a real alignment in the Catholic world between sort of talent, networks, platforms, financing that doesn't necessarily occur in the evangelical world. And so I think that, you know, there's a reason why, you know, I look, for example, there's this group, it's like called the New Polity Project. And it, you know, you may have never heard of them, but it's sort of quasi like Catholic integralism. Not entirely. It's sort of an alternative to Catholic integralism. And a lot of this group is sort of, they orbit around Steubenville, Ohio, which has a Catholic university there whose name escapes me. And so it's like, you know, Steubenville is becoming like this hotbed of Catholic intellectual. You know, Steubenville's a Appalachian, Ohio town on the Ohio River, you know, and like people are moving there. They're having conferences there. You know, so obviously there's financial and other resources being brought to bear around this nucleus. So there's an institution, there's an existing institution, there's finances, there's a geographic location, and there's a group of intellectuals around this New Polity movement and other things. And that sort of thing is very rare, I think, in the evangelical world. to see. And so, yeah, I think Catholics, I think there's a lot to learn from Catholicism.
Well, you do lay out some major kind of, I would say, things to aspire to, I think, for evangelicals and for Protestants. You list out the pursuit of excellence, anti-fragility, ownership, acquiring ownership, and then speaking the truth clearly. And I'm just curious if you want to open up those a little bit. You don't have to go super in depth because, you know, you got to read the book to find out everything. But I thought those are some strong statements that I think have a lot of insight. So would you like to open up a little bit of what that would mean?
Sure. And so there's a lot there. I mean, again, we, you know, ever since Mark Knoll wrote that book, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, it's been well known that evangelicals lack in intellectualism and other things. And the truth is, you know, when, you know, most of the intellectuals were at least, you know, not hostile to Christianity and his views, you know, you could rely on them. Well, now you can't. And so you know, so I think we have to be, the world's harder today. Like, it's just harder to get married and stay married today. It's harder to have a successful career. You know, the world is harder. And when the world is hard, you got to elevate your game. Got to be excellent. Again, ownership. I was sort of inspired by the guys in Moscow, Idaho from this. I mean, you got to Moscow, Idaho with Doug Wilson, this hyper conservative, like, you know, Christian group in this actually college town, state university college town in Idaho, has nevertheless, like, they own half of the main street, it seems like. Wow. They have their, I mean, it's wild. They have their own coffee shops, their own university, their own, you know, classical Christian school, their own pizza place, their own gastro pub, their own theater. It's like they own a ton of stuff. They own a ton of businesses. And when you own a lot of stuff, you have a lot of ability to do things. Like, my old church in New York actually, I think, grew a lot during COVID. You know why? They owned their own building and they could open. As soon as it was legal to be open, they were open. Whereas some people who are renting, the landlord doesn't get a lot of meat. So it's not even that they chose to do that, but the landlord's down. So when you decide that you want to, you know, when you decide that you want to live in a world where people don't like you, like, relying on them to sell you things, to rent you things, you got to think a lot more about ownership. So those are some of the things I think about. And then the speaking truth clearly, I think we talked a little bit about Jordan Peterson. I my model is Jordan Peterson. Look at how he has attracted a massive following by saying some rather banal things, you know? And yeah. I think people are looking for it.
Well, what advice would you give to pastors? I mean, I think you've touched on that a little bit in your book, but in your writings, you have very much a concern for the churches. I appreciated that you had mentioned something where, like, that essentially pastors are being asked to do too much, in a sense of you've got to be a psychotherapist, a social critic, a political commentator, on top of, you know, exegeting Hebrews, you know. And I'm just wondering, I want to hear some of your thoughts about that. What can pastors take?
Sure. I do think, you know, pastors, you know, I think one, if you're going to go into, be called into ministry, you're going to be tougher. You know, it's already a tough job. Now it's even tougher. I mean, stress, burnout, intra-church conflict, it's a major issue. If you're a pastor today, no matter what you teach, you're hearing it from somebody. You're getting zapped on that. So that's number one. Number two, I think that, yeah, I mean, you know, again, the lack of evangelical intellectuals has meant that by default, the experts on everything have to be pastors. It's like, we don't look, you know, in the Catholic world, it's like, oh, who's our political guy? It's Patrick Deneen. Now, not all Catholics like Patrick Deneen, but here's a political scientist who's a Catholic who can talk about the political order from an authoritative perspective, you know, as a college professor who's Catholic. You know, in the evangelical world, you know, we don't have those people. So it's like, who do we call? We call Tim Keller. Tim, you know, please tell us, you know, and he did a great job on a lot of things. But I mean, the fact is, you know, the pastors are not experts on a lot of things. And when they try to become experts, they really can cause a lot of harm. And I think that's what happened with the purity culture. You know, the purity culture, like the Bible doesn't really say anything about dating. And all of a sudden, this book, I Kissed Dating Goodbye, by a 21-year-old guy with massive amounts of very specific advice, very little of it that's from the Bible, kind of takes over the world. It actually hurt a lot of people. And so I think that, you know, we need to have more, that's why I say we need to have more lay experts, more geniuses. Jordan Peterson is a psychologist, and he talks about the world through the lens of Jungian psychology and these things. You know, Jocko's a Navy SEAL. You know, he learned a lot about leadership and commanding in his SEAL and working in the SEAL teams. And, you know, these people like actually have some expertise. And so we need to have people who like are experts in their field who are talking about those things from a Christian perspective, not calling up, you know, John Piper and asking him how you're supposed to date today. Like, John Piper is, you know, what, 70 something years old. He got married a long time ago. He doesn't know anything about dating today. Nothing. And that's not his fault. And it's not his job either. I think we need to have, you know, that's why I say we need much more lay expertise on a lot of things.
That's a good word. You know, it's been a couple of years since you originally wrote that first article. And then in between that and writing your book, has anything shifted? Was there any feedback or critique that you were like, okay, I'm going to implement that, or any shift in your thoughts?
Well, I certainly did change the book, make changes and updates in order to address criticisms. Not that I thought the criticisms were wrong, but I think, you know, one of the biggest changes that I made is in the article, it says the positive world was prior to 1994. In the book, I put a start date on the positive world. It's from 1964 to 1994. Because I wanted to be clear, the positive world is not things are great. Things were bad in the positive world for a lot of people. It was a period of decline, but Christianity was still viewed positively.
Gotcha.
And yeah.
So maybe just in conclusion, I want to hear your thoughts on the future. You know, when you think about where things are headed, I know we kind of touched a little bit on it. We're in a time of fragmentation, but what are some opportunities you see for the church to capitalize on in a negative world?
Well, unfortunately, you know, there's a lot of problems with people in this world. You know, we have declining life expectancy in the United States. You know, there's a lot of growth in what economists have called deaths of despair, suicides, opioid addictions, alcoholism. And so we need, I think wherever there's these issues with people suffering in all of these world, in all of these ways, then, you know, there's always an opportunity for ministry. We have a severe homeless problem, you know, in America today. We have a lot of, the needs are actually overwhelming in terms of just straight up loving your neighbor. I mean, the loneliness, there's so many people who are lonely. You know, that's one of the things I noticed in New York. A lot of people who came to my church, it was not that they came there specifically because they were lonely, but you can tell they were looking for connection. They were hoping to find community there. And one of the things people always said about that church was, wow, you guys have the best community here of any church in Chicago, I mean, in New York. I'm like, really? Because like in most parts of the country, this would be normal. But in New York, where it's such an atomized culture, it massively stands out. And I think about even the street I live on in suburban Indianapolis today, I bet just a 2-3 block long length of my street, there are so many people that have pain and problems that I don't even know about. And I think that that is always like the best opportunity to reach people for the gospel is when things are going poorly, you know, when you hit rock bottom. So I think that's a lot. I think that's a lot of it, you know, is that sort of thing going to be big. There's a lot of people in pain out there.
It's a good word. And I think sometimes that can be lost, you know, when you're just thinking abstractly about ideas and culture and all this stuff, and you realize that, you know, the human suffering and the things that people are dealing with, there is a hope that you can give them. And, you know, right. I think that's always a thing that's, I guess in any age, right, that's always something you can bank on.
Right.
It's something to offer people in suffering.
Yeah. I mean, I tell you, like, I mean, I do think it's weird that one of the takeaways people've got from taken from my book is that we need to be harder core on politics? Because, I mean, to be honest, I think, you know, the culture war is kind of a loser. You know, I mean, I think if you're in a minority and you're trying to like cram your beliefs down people's throats, it's not going to work. You're just going to make them not like you. And so I really think you got to think twice about that sort of stuff.
No, you know, that's something that I thought was really interesting about your book. You talk about that. You talk about how some of the reactionary movements just aren't realistic, and that, you know, it's not necessarily compromised to be prudential about these types of things. And just to, you know, I just think you had a very real kind of view of how right. the world works and what's possible and what can actually be achieved without being overly, you know, pessimistic. But right. Yeah, and I think it's true. I think you even talk about just like caring for the homeless and caring for people in need. I mean, that's just basic Christian stuff. It doesn't have to be something that you're, you know, overtly political. You know, there are some yeah. things that we can do just locally and publicly.
I think so. I think localism is a big, you know, big thing we think about.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, Aaron, I feel like I could talk to you for another hour. I mean, this was just a fascinating conversation. Appreciate the work that you're doing. Appreciate you taking the time on to come and talk on our show. We're going to put a link in our show notes to your book so people can go get it. We'll also put a link to your YouTube channel as well as your Substack. Make sure you subscribe to the Substack. It's a lot of great stuff it puts out. And Aaron, thank you for your work. Appreciate you coming on. Hope to have you on again sometime.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. You can visit our website, our YouTube channel. You can subscribe to our podcast. All those links are in the show notes. And also consider supporting us on Patreon. That would be a great benefit to us. You can find that link in the show notes as well. Thank you for listening to the show.